And thanks for the introduction to this very fascinating institute here. Yeah, we stick to the topic. It will be also on collider signatures of extremely weakly interacting dark matter candidates. And why is this relevant for this workshop? Because it really tells you or shows you the implications that these constraints from Big Bang nucleosynthesis and catalyzed Big Bang nucleosynthesis can have. And so my major motivation to look in this field is this evidence for that matter that we have in the universe, which you're all aware of. And so you know, we have this evidence that so about 22% of the whole energy content in the universe should be made out of this dark matter. And since neutrinos are light, we know that the identity of dark matter, that this points to physics beyond the standard model. So it's a key question. What is the identity of dark matter? And so here we will look at supersymmetric dark matter candidates. The most popular of the supersymmetric dark matter candidates is the lightest neutralino, which is the mixture of this vino, the neutral hexenos. This is a spin 1/2 particle. It has a mass at the weak scale, and it's a weakly interacting particle. So this will be in contrast to the candidates that I will discuss next. And here it's again this plot here that illustrates this what is called the constrained minimal supersymmetric standard model. Josef has already introduced this, so maybe once more you have these parameters here. M0, that's an assumption on your scalar masses. You assume that at the gut scale they have this universal value M0, and for your fermions you assume the universal value M1/2. And if such a plot is shown, what you have to keep in mind is that each plot in this plane is associated with a well-defined spectrum, a very realistically looking spectrum. And that spectrum you get from the renormalization group evaluation up from the gut scale down to the electroweak scale. And with neutralinos, well, it's this standard mechanism how they are produced in the universe that goes under the name WIMP, freeze out, weakly interacting massive particles. They are in the early universe, they follow the equilibrium distribution until their annihilation becomes not efficient anymore. It's too dilute here at this point. And then they decouple from the plasma, and that would be what ends up in dark matter within the model like the constraint minimal supersymmetric standard model. There are very convenient tools available where you just can press the button and you get this relic abundance. So it's many channels which can be important in there. And yeah, so this micro omegas gives you here that these contour lines that also Josef showed in the previous plot. And okay, so here's the Stau region. And let's go to this in a bit larger. Here's the Stau region. There is the neutralino region. So here we talk about neutralino LSP. That's we concentrate on this. And here from this masses that is here and the contour lines of the yield that is here, you get then the relic density. So you basically have to multiply the blue dotted with the solid lines. And if you do this, then you get, for example, here this green area where you really agree with the observed abundance of dark matter. And it's quite a thin strip, actually, in this neutralino region. So it's really very sensitive to your supersymmetric model. But still, nevertheless, it's possible to get the right amount of dark matter with these neutralinos, as you all are aware. We only will need one more.
I think that's the strength. I think actually it's a strength because, I mean,
okay, let's be optimistic. Maybe nature likes the CMSSM and has realized the CMSSM. And you really probe that at a collider. You can extrapolate to the gut scale. You find it looks like a CMSSM. And you find that you sit here on this line. It would be very nice, right? Because it's so thin, the line, and with Planck it will be.
Okay, that's vanilla supersymmetry, of course. But yeah, still, it looks realistic. It's good to play this. Yeah, since I won't say much of the neutralino, nevertheless, I want to show
the scorecard here that I discussed already. Well, they freeze out when they are non-relativistic, so it's guaranteed that they will be really cold dark matter. And on the experimental side, these guys are very nice because of their weak interactions. they would still, in overdense regions, maybe in the course of galaxies, they would annihilate once in a while. You get energetic cosmic rays. You might observe them with telescope satellite experiments. That's these indirect surges. You have direct surges where neutralinos scatter for the first time after the BBN, maybe meeting a nuclear sphere. And this nucleus receives a recoil, and there are very, very clean experiments that are now looking for such events. The best ones at the moment are xenon 10 and CDMS. And then, of course, we have the collider, where I will say a bit more on this later on. But there, in principle, if any SUSY particle that you produce would cascade down to the neutralino in the end, to the lightest supersymmetric particle.
That you have light enough sports and
light enough neutrinos, right? That is very important. And I should say, throughout my talk, I will assume that R parity is conserved, so that the lightest supersymmetric particle is really stable. And Koichi will comment on scenarios where R parity can be violated. Yeah, so that brings me already to the gravitino. So we have this nice introduction by Josef already. So I will do it in a much more simple-minded way and just remind you that it's the superpart of the graviton and the gauge field associated with supersymmetry breaking.
So as Josef already stressed, thereby the mass of the gravitino depends very much on the breaking scenario that we assume for supersymmetry. So it can be like EV scale, very light, or it can also be very heavy, like in a normally mediated supersymmetry breaking or Mirage mediated supersymmetry breaking. When we talk here about supersymmetric dark matter candidates, we want the gravitino to be the lightest supersymmetric particle. So we are more interested here in this lower gravitino masses. Nevertheless, we treat the gravitino mass like the free parameter. Yeah, and again, I really want to emphasize, I mean, since very often the neutralino is discussed and the gravitino might sound a bit exotic, it's really not exotic. I mean, this is really something at the heart of supersymmetry. And the interactions of the gravitino, they are really given by the supergravity Lagrangian. So that is something very beautiful in itself, I would say. And so here, from there, you can read of these interactions that Josef has shown already. There you find this suppression by higher dimensional, some dimensionful mass scale, Planck scale. And yeah, so the gravitino is really something that is not crazy. As the superpartner of the graviton, the gravitino has very, very small interactions. So it's the gravitino is an extremely weakly interacting particle in contrast to the neutralino, which is a weakly interacting particle due because of this suppression by the Planck scale. Yeah. And because of that fact, gravitinos typically are not in thermal equilibrium in the early universe because simply the interactions are not strong enough. Now you might wonder, well, if this is the case, how can you get gravitino abundance that could anyhow give you the right dark matter density? Yeah? But what helps you here is that in these couplings, yeah, you have to, for dimensional reasons, you have to compensate for this Planck scale here in the denominator. So what you get always the typical energy scale of the process in the numerator. And now if you have a very hot early universe, 10 to the 7 GeV, then that's what enters up here, and that's what compensates this Planck scale suppression in large parts. Yeah? And thereby this thermal production that Josef was discussing at length becomes important. And yeah, as Josef was already discussing, this is actually not so simple. You have to do it in thermal field theory, use hard thermal loop propagators. I think Keith also did this. I think this was actually the first paper using this hard thermal loop resumation technique in the context of gravitino. And yeah, thermal gravitino production. So this is something very generic. Yeah, you don't have it only. You not only have it in gravitino dark matter scenarios where the gravitino is stable, you also have it in this neutralino dark matter scenarios. Yeah? If you think that SUSY is a local symmetry, then you always will have the gravitino. Next question is the gravitino stable or unstable? In the neutralino LSP case, it will be unstable and it will decay. And that's what Kazi Kori showed in his talk. Then you get these important constraints. I will show them on the next slide. So the gravitino is always there with this thermal production. Yeah? And it will thereby always give you some constraints on the reheating temperature. So here are these plots that Josef showed for this stable gravitino scenarios. And this is the plot that Mr. Kori showed here for the unstable gravitino scenarios. Yeah, and here the yield of the gravitino from thermal production matters. Here it matters when you compare it to the relic to the dark matter density, while here it matters because the yield of gravitinos that are there, if the yield is higher, more gravitinos can decay into hadronic energy that can spoil BBN, and thereby you get these constraints. Yeah, and if you liked high reheating temperatures like the ones that you needed for thermal leptogenesis, people very much liked the gravitino scenario because it looked here that in the gravitino scenario, you can have these temperatures of 10 to the 9 GeV, which you need for this most simple standard leptogenesis scenario. While here, for an unstable gravitino, you are up here and you need to have a gravitino mass that is very heavy, about 5 TeV or heavier, in order to have high reheating temperatures possible. So green is the possible region. Yeah. So you mean here in this?
Yeah, this is 500 GeV.
What is corresponding neutralino mass at low
energy? I think it's about the neutralino mass.
Yeah, yeah.
It's above the. Yeah.
Well, like it's larger, it's still larger than that gravitino mass. Because in the lava region, you can't come up with lava.
Now, you're of course right. I mean, there will be some bounce coming in from the. That will
come in. To be the nuclear SP.
Right.
There's a room. There's a window.
Here. There is a window.
Okay. Yes.
Can also have a. So for a neutrino NLSP, that's still a good picture, actually. For Stau NLSP, that was what Josef was discussing. You have this additional constraints from CBBN, and then you find here this much severer limit than you can find here within the CMSSM, that 10 to the 7 could be the maximum temperature that you could get. Yeah? So it's really, that's something that comes from the CBBN. Maybe. I will say a bit more on it later. Yeah, so I discussed now the thermal production. Now I also will mention that the production from NLSP decays. So if the gravitino is the LSP, there will still be another party that is the lightest standard model super partner. That could be the Stau now, for example. Yeah? And the Stau, I mean, that's has relatively strong couplings. That would be in thermal equilibrium. It would not realize that there's a gravitino around, and at some point it would decouple as the neutralino does from the plasma until it realizes very late, because then really the suppression by the Planck scale sets in. Yeah. Here you have temperatures 10 GeV, that won't compensate much of the Planck scale suppression. So here at a very late time, for each Stau NLSP, you get a gravitino LSP plus some standard model particles, and that's the particle that is probably most interesting for potential collider signatures here.
Yeah, what you should keep, so from that you get, of course, also gravitino, so that's an additional contribution to the relic density of gravitino dark matter. And so you know, another point that is important now here, while this region with the Stau as the lightest standard model superpartner is usually not considered in this neutralino dark matter scenarios, now with the gravitino dark matter, that is possible, and it's really a sizable region even in this CMSSM parameter space. Yeah, so here is a plot now that shows you in the parameter space spent by the gravitino and the Stau mass, where you typically get the right amount of dark matter from these decays alone. Yeah, and so there is a very typical yield assumed that was derived in a paper by Koichi and others some years ago. And here within this trip, you get the right amount of dark matter, and you see here in this trip, you can have very high Stau masses of 1 TeV and also very high gravitino mass. So this super WIMP region there for the Stau is at values that are not very collider friendly, actually. Everything else here is allowed. If you have, of course, already gravitinos coming from thermal production, if like 10 or let's say 90% comes from thermal production, then this limit will become stronger. This will become a limit and will move to here. Or if you have 99% coming from thermal production, then everything here will be ruled out because of too much dark matter. And yeah, since we had the discussion this morning on this structure formation arguments, I also would like to show here a table, maybe to contribute that for the discussion that we might have this evening. So this is now taken here from this paper that I did. I collected in very simple-minded way some objects that you have here at some redshift values, and in order to have this redshift, you cannot have too high velocities of your dark matter particles. And people that do these studies, usually they quantify the constraints for warm dark matter in terms of the mass of this warm dark matter particle, because that's, they assume, a hot relic always. Or you can quantify it, that was also what Manoj was doing, that in terms of the free streaming velocity, and also Carsten did a paper on that. Here is this reionization, that is what Carsten was including in his paper. And yeah, so these are the constraints. On the other hand, you would hope to, with warm dark matter, to, as Manoj was stressing, to solve this small scale structure problem. So how does this look like now for gravitinos that come from Stau in an SPD case? Well, there, this free streaming velocity that is shown here, there are contours. Here it's 0.01 kilometers per second, for example. That depends on the Stau mass and on the gravitino mass, yeah? And the region here above this, that would be, that would correspond to warm dark matter. And that's exactly the region where you had the stripe, where you had the super WIMP scenario, yeah? Of course, these, if you want to use this as a constraint, then that would apply only to the case where you have the most part coming from these decays. You want to have a negligible contribution from thermal production because that is cold. And if you want to have warm gravitino dark matter, you need, let's say, 90% coming from the decays. Yeah. But that is only in this region, and there you meet really this constraints with dark matter. Yeah, gravitinos from thermal production, they are so early produced, there's so much time to redshift, so they are slow, they are typically cold dark matter. Yeah, to sum this up, you can get the right relic abundance with gravitino dark matter already from these two guaranteed production mechanisms, thermal one and NLSPD case. I did not discuss inflaton decays, that is also an important issue, but maybe a bit more model dependent. Crucial question in comparison to the neutralino, where we had this nice experimental prospect, is can we probe gravitino dark matter in experiments? And there we won't have a chance with direct detection or indirect searches if R parity is conserved. And with the direct production of gravitinos at colliders, that will also be very difficult, except for a very light gravitino. Yeah. Because a very light gravitino, then the Goldsteiner components become important, and that couples relatively strongly. So that you could have even from the vertex region, but it must be like a EV gravitino, very light, yeah. Much less than EV, okay. So maybe Koichi's talk at Pascos, right? You will address this.
Not direct product.
Your enhancement factor is naively weak scale over the mass of the gravitino.
It's like N minus 3,
yeah. Yeah, so you really.
Okay, maybe by direct production, I mean just at the end of the cascade, but from within the vertex region. I don't
the electron volt, yeah.
I don't, sorry, maybe it's. Yeah, and but yeah, let's look again at this picture here with the Stau NLSP, and what is shown here is contours of the Stau lifetime. Yeah, you see here you have 1 second, 100 seconds, Stau is a charged particle, and with a lifetime longer than 100 seconds, that would for a collider
practically be a stable particle. So you would expect at the LHC with in such a scenario, such a Stau NLSP scenario, that every SUSY particle that is produced here at the LHC would cascade down to a Stau. So if R parity is conserved for each SUSY event, you would get in the end a pair of stable looking Staus. And that is something that people already were searching for example, at the LET experiments. And from there, we have limits. We know that if such a Stau exists, then it should have a mass above 100 GeV. Searches at Tevatron are still going on. There is still data from the Fermilab experiments analyzed. They are now not competitive with the LEP limits, but yeah. No.
2009. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's Maybe in 2009 we see some stainless stuff.
Or maybe 2008.
Just to comment on the picture, it's very rare that they would go back to back, right? They would be more like...
True. Yeah, two vibes by INC. Yeah, okay, so it gives me a chance to really introduce the big hope for all of us particle physics. Yeah? This machine, the Large Hadron Collider, is two experiments here.
Where we would hope to see such events, namely ATLAS or the CMS detector. You collide protons head-on to the center of mass energy of 14 TeV. And
they start with lower energies. Yeah, and that's what we want to see. Yeah, so that's a track here of such a long-lived star here in the CMS detector. So that's what we are hoping for to see as a signature. Yeah.
For comparison, it's good to remind ourselves of the neutralino signature, which is very different. Namely, that is an excess in missing energy. And missing energy for colliders is a very nasty thing. You need to understand your collider detector very precisely. I mean, if there are cells in there that are not functioning, they give you missing energy, right? So you really have to understand the machine before you really can claim that a missing energy signature would be a neutralino or new physics. Why is this with this missing energy? Well, let's look at a sample event here in a neutralino LSP scenario. You would, in the first place, well, you collide protons that contain quarks and gluons, strongly interacting particles. So you would produce strongly interacting superparticles like gluinos. They are typically heavy, and they would cascade down into the lightest one. And along the cascade, you get energetic jets, hadronic jets, or leptons. And in the end, you have like at the end of the SUSY chain, you always have this neutralino, which is invisible as neutrinos are. So that is what gives you the missing energy. Yeah, now, in the scenarios with the gravitino, that does not need to be the neutralino. That would be the star, for example. And then at the end of each SUSY cascade, you would have the star, this stable looking particle, which would make collider studies a lot easier, actually. Yeah, so that is the signal one would hope for. And that's what brings us to the connection here in this BDN workshop. Here we have such lifetimes, 1 second, 100 seconds. So if you have these guys with such a lifetime in the early universe, they'd be around at Big Bang nuclear synthesis. Yeah, that's here the topic of this workshop. And yeah, that's a cartoon here of such processes where you have a late decaying star, maybe when the universe was 10 hours old instead of 2008, it was 10 hours, the star decayed, and these hadronic jets, they dissociate helium into deuterium, and that can spoil that picture. And there has been huge activities to understand these things, and like this is only a selection of papers where these effects were studied, and goes back to 88, and yeah, Keith is an expert, and I mean, Corey, I mean, Carsten.
The framework for decaying particles was probably started very early. Mm-hmm.
And these are the constraints I use from Corey's paper here, and also from the paper by Seibert et al. For the electromagnetic ones. That's what I used in order to produce this plot here, these constraints. This is again the plane here with the gravitino and the star mass, and this is this from electromagnetic energy injection. This is disfavored here. From hadronic, this one is disfavored. And that's where the super WIMPs live. So super WIMPs can still live up here for a 2 TeV M star, but then they would really be Wormbach matter and might resolve small scale structure problems, but you won't see them at LHC. Yeah, this was the picture until May 2006. So it's an exciting field. I mean, that's when Maxime's paper appeared on this process, which I try to demonstrate in this cartoon. Yeah, I had to write something for public outreach and how do you explain to the public catalyzed BDN. Yeah, not so simple. Okay, so that's the picture. That's lithium-6. You may count it's 6 balls here, like these dark ones. And so on. So this is catalyzed BDN on already there. Since these 2 years, we have an enormous activity. And this stuff is getting more and more refined, and I think it will stay like this for some time, maybe. And yeah, Josef introduced already our relatively simple treatment of that with just using this reaction here and Hamaguchi et al. Result. That's what we use for these exclusion lines. And making a comparison with Carsten's papers, we were, of course, quite happy to see that, although it's so simple-minded, that the agreement with Carsten's papers is really quite good if you take into account all these other uncertainties that you have now. Yeah, and that now taking this limit, then you have here this additional exclusion limit, and everything below that is disfavored. So you see this lithium six bound from CBBN really dominates the BBN constraints. So it's really the most important constraint in most of the parameter space. Only the hadronic one can become a bit more severe up here for these large splittings in the masses. And yeah, so if you see these things at colliders, we want to contrast it with that. Now, with that, you might be able to measure the Stau mass, for example. Let's assume you measure a Stau mass of 500 GeV, that's relatively heavy already. Then these BBN constraints would tell you that your gravitino should at most be as heavy as 20 GeV. Yeah? And since the gravitino mass is reflects the Suzy breaking scale, you basically have an upper bound on the Suzy breaking scale, assuming that this scenario is realized in nature. Yeah? So it's really here could become a fantastic interplay between collider physics and cosmology, so really astroparticle physics. Yeah.
In the CMSSM, you can't do that, right? When you're having stars that are that heavy,
you would need your gluino would be much heavier. In the CMSSM, that is a problem,
right.
And that is actually was also. I have it a bit later. What Josef was showing, I mean, and also you had it in a paper, this lithium constraint in the CBBN on m1/2, and it tells you your gluinos have to be heavier than 2.5 TeV, and then you would not see any Suzy at the LHC.
But it would be healthy that the experimentalists would not, believe in any of these constraints necessarily very strong. Explore everything, right, with an open mind, otherwise.
I mean, what's maybe a bit misleading here is, I mean, I stopped this plot here at 5 GeV gravitino. I mean, if the gravitino gets lighter, then the lifetime becomes smaller, and you can have stars even as light as 200 GeV. So gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking is not that much affected by these stars. Yeah, and that's something else that also Koichi will mention. I think that's extremely optimistic here, 2017. That was some years ago, maybe, where you could hope for that, 2037 or something. Oh, yeah. Okay, the hope would be, since this is a charged particle,
it has energy loss in material. And the hope would be that you can produce these guys somehow slowly. ILC would mean you are able to tune the threshold energy, make them slow, and they lose energy, and maybe they get stuck and sit there and decay. And that is something that Koichi will discuss a bit more in his talk. And there you will hear about a possible measurement of the Planck scale. Maybe how would that go? Well, if these stars get stuck there, they would sit there and then at some point decay through the gravitino and the tau. This is so the lifetime is governed by this two-body decay. Here is the expression for the widths. It depends on the gravitino mass here and on the Stau mass. So by the time you are able to collect these things, you will definitely know the Stau mass already. So that you know the Planck scale. So the lifetime measurement would directly be a measurement of the gravitino mass. Yeah. Well, it's a two-body decay. And in a two-body decay, kinematics is very simple. So from a two-body decay, you can also have the gravitino mass from the kinematics here. Plug that in, and then you can compare here the Planck scale that you get from that with the macroscopic Planck scale. And that is, I think, a very nice paper by Koichi and collaborators where they discuss this. And an agreement here would certainly be like evidence for gravitino dark matter. And yeah, with such a measurement of the gravitino mass, one could also like probe the viability of thermal leptogenesis at colliders. So here, yeah, maybe I don't have time to explain the full thing in this plot. the green region would be the allowed one. If you are above these lines, you have too much gravitino dark matter. So you could see, I mean, with the given reheating temperature needed for thermal leptogenesis, whether you sit in the green region. But unfortunately, as I was already stressing, thermal leptogenesis is excluded by the BBN constraints. So thereby also this region where you would want to probe these temperatures is here excluded by the constraint from CBBN. So no probing of thermal leptogenesis since you have this bound on the heating temperature anyhow. Yeah, can one identify the gravitino experimentally? How much time do I have actually?
10 minutes. Oh, that's good.
Okay. Can one identify the gravitino experimentally? Yeah, best thing would of course be the Planck measurement. But the problem is that requires this kinematical determination in order not having the gravitino mass disappearing in the error of this kinematic determination. It should be sizable. It should be larger than about 10% of the Stau mass. And now comes.
This stuff you accumulate, obviously.
This is simply because it's Tau, and Tau decay carries energy carried by a neutrino. So it's not just that, it's, I mean, there's some Tau. It's difficult to really.
So even in the case of the infinite statistics, right?
Then it works. You have to precisely measure the endpoint of the Tau decay so that to see the pair.
What I meant is that the reason number of events somewhere in this form built in into this estimate already.
I think we should show some detailed plots on that, right? The gravitino, Stau mass relation. Okay, I mean, but the problem is now with CBBN, without CBBN, you know, so here is what is shown, here is the line, and if you are below the line, you will fulfill this requirement below the line. So with the old bounds, it looked very nice, right? You are really in this region. Light Stau mass, this could be true, yeah? But now with this CBBN, this line is really deep in the excluded region. And yeah, that's of course it's a problem for that measurement. And here's again the CBBN. This is again the plots that Josef showed. Here again, the red region is the one that is favored by CBBN. Here is the gluino contour of 2.5 TeV. So you would probe SUSY only here in this region. So it looks that it really could be very hard to probe supersymmetry at all. But really, here you really have to keep in mind that this limit here is very sensitive to the gravitino mass that you choose. So if the gravitino mass becomes lighter, then these limits disappear and you can really have supersymmetry. So that's something to please keep in mind. I mean, this gravitino dark matter means not now that we won't see SUSY at the LHC. With a very light gravitino, lighter than 1 GeV, everything could still be possible. Warning, Josef was already stressing this. In all these bounds that I showed you, we assumed a standard cosmological history. So if you have something like Josef was addressing late time entropy production, you can evade these limits to some extent. Yeah, so coming back to the comparison between neutralino and gravitino, then we see that with the Stau, we could even have also in the gravitino case experimental prospects to observe them. Another extremely weakly interacting candidate that I will mention here in these last minutes is the Axino, that is the superpartner of the Axion. Mr. Kori was already mentioning this, has also extremely weakly interactions here. They are suppressed by the Petrick wind scale, which we know that must be larger than 10^9 GeV, as we know from Axion searches. Here it's unfortunately the interactions are much more model dependent. I mean, in the gravitino case, it was just the supergravity Lagrange, and that's something that comes really from symmetry principles. Here in the Axino case, you have a different Axion model, so a lot more to play with the Axion sector. In other.
I think that the model to predict the smaller mass of Axion. Personally, I don't understand why the lighter Axion mass is positive. for example, like a nanometer scale or like a...
Yeah, but I mean, there are different papers available, and model builders are usually very creative, so I think,
Can it be like, say, a model where you have almost exact supersymmetry in the in this axion sector, and you know, communication of Susie breaking to axion sector is suppressed by one or a phase? Is this possible? You'd probably get to some KD scales.
KD means the gravity scale, non-visibility.
Well, you know, there's various models like this neutrino varying mass that some people play that they slap on in the sector that is, almost supersymmetric, and the communication is more supersymmetric than the stairwell in the sense that the splitting in the supermultiple is much smaller. And you can try to make it sort of semi-natural, but because this sector is one over. The coupling is small, it's one over half. I don't know if, so the standard.
But then you would have a very light axion.
Sort of KD. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like a huge degree of freedom, right? I could have.
EV.
We can look at the region where it would could provide the right amount of dark matter.
Maybe.
Again, you have this thermal production at this NMSP decays, and thermal production has here this kind of very different dependence on the mass of your LSP, but you could still have an agreement, and but you can have also very severe bounds on the reheating temperature. So here's now the axino mass. Here is 1 MeV, there is 1 KeV, and so here you have reheating temperatures that are above the temperatures where axinos would be in thermal equilibrium. That's why the bound disappears. So then you have axinos ex hoc relics, basically. That's why the bound disappears. And yeah, so the light carbon axinos would live here. Would also be an option, then you would have axion dark matter, probably. Yeah. Non-thermal production is exactly the same plot than in the Gravitino case. That does not depend on the details of the decay, only on these masses here. And on the yield, of course, what is not shown is this contour lifetimes of the contour lines of the lifetime. They are different than in the Gravitino case, typically shorter lived. Yeah. And thereby, these BVN constraints are really much less important in the axino case. And to have the CBVN setting in, you need a very high Peccei-Quinn scale that you would disregard maybe already from naturalness arguments when you think about coherent oscillations of your axion field. Here the collider signatures could be very similar to the Gravitino case. You could have this long-lived Staus. Here from there it would not be possible directly to say whether it's the axion or the Gravitino. For that you would need here these collection experiments and maybe observe these two-body and three-body decays. And for the distinction you would look first of all at the lifetime, of course, that you measure. But there is a big overlap. I mean, if the lifetime that you see is within 0.1 seconds and 10 hours, there could be either the axino or the gravitino, both would be possible. Only very long or very short lifetimes could point to the gravitino if you are in between and need something else. And that help might come here from these three body decays. There is more information associated with them, although they are more rare than the two body decay. Here's the Feynman diagrams, and what do you observe in such a three-body decay here, for example, the photon and the tau. You might be able to measure the opening angle and the photon energy, and you can calculate, of course, this double differential decay rate and plot this. And what you find is very interesting that in a hadronic axion model, KSVZ axion model, you can have an excess here in this high-energy photon region that you cannot have in the Gravitino case. There your most photons come here from this collinear or soft photon region. So in the axino, you have an excess here. Why is that? Because this the importance of this diagram relative to the others is more important in the axino case than in the Gravitino.
of these things, right? Otherwise, you just don't have any sensitivity.
Yeah, we did some simple estimation, right, in here how much you would need to collect. I think 10 to the, was it 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5?
Yeah, I think this investigated it with the paper with Noji.
Ah, okay.
With thousands or 10,000, it could be distinguished.
It's 10,000.
Yeah, I can look up.
10,000 total decays, and of that, 10,000 total collected cells, then you have two body decays and three body, and then you...
Oh, sorry, then it must be more. I will check it.
Okay. So what if it is the axeno, then you again have two body decay, and that's almost the final slide that I have here. Here you also have an expression for the decay rate, and now it, instead of depending on the Planck scale, it depends on the axeno, on this patch and print scale, and on the axeno mass only if it is sizable with respect to the star mass, otherwise it depends only on the patch and print scale. So measuring the lifetime would be a measure for these two quantities. If you are now able to do this kinematic measurement, you would have a kinematic measurement of the axeno mass. Here, if you are in the region where this kinematic measurement is not possible, this dependent drops out here anyhow. Yeah? So if there you are on the side where you can basically always probe from such lifetime measurements the patch and print scale. And that you can then take your value that you get there and confront it with your bounds that you have from axion physics, that you ask, are you here in the region that is consistent with axion searches? Who knows, maybe that is true, that that would be a strong hint for the axeno NSP. And yeah, that's basically the end of my talk. Here is again this summary slide of all these candidates, and here I was concentrating more on these extremely weakly interacting dark matter candidates, the collider signatures, and BBM constraints that you have. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I'm very interested in such a discrimination between the gradino and axeno. But you like harmonic axiom, harmonic axiom.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take the BFZ model, so is there any difference for the three body decay or something?
Yeah, that would be definitely
the difference. Yeah. So that can help. Okay, if the BFZ is correct, then you can see discrimination.
We didn't try. I mean, that's all we did was so far this hadronic KSVC axial model. And already there, I mean, what is this model you have? Well, there the axion couples to the normal particles via some loop of heavy quarks.
Yeah.
Heavy quarks, maybe 10 to the 10 GeV quarks. Yeah. They are here in this loop.
Yeah,
and it's better here on the screenboard. Here you have always this triangle, which is this. Which is this heavy quark loop, yeah. And already there you have quite some freedom. I mean, what color charges do you ascribe to these quarks, or what quantum numbers, yeah? And there's already some freedom in KSVC, you have, of course, different additional climate diagrams. I mean, it would be very interesting if you could do it. And
you were talking about that at the LHC you could not see observe supersymmetry, like if your Bruno mass be above 2.5 GeV, something like that.
Right? Yeah.
And I wonder, isn't it very dependent on what the stable ordinary supersymmetric particle would be? So the Stau, which is not really. Or the neutralino, because you say also like the star you would see such a clear signature, whereas with neutralino you just have some missing energy. So you wonder if you, by virtual production or by virtual production of Bruinos, you actually produce a star in the end, like which is a rare event.
Yep.
With statistics,
yep.
You see it so yep. Well that you could actually extend this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that is maybe this in the star scenario, maybe this 2.5 TeV is a bit pessimistic. I mean, usually when you see collider reaches plotted, what people look at is the neutralino LSP scenario, and then if you calculate there the collider reach, you look at the missing energy. Like you want to have enough significant missing energy signature, and with the Stau probably it would be much easier. And maybe then the collider reach would extend to higher values of the Guarino mass. That might very well be.
I guess one would have to need to know how large the cross section is to produce a star omen by the assumption that you have a large efficiency of actually detecting this heavy charge.
I mean, you can of course also produce it via some Dreyang processes where you have quark, anti-quark going directly to star omen. So this, I mean, I also try to avoid here to make it really to say, 2.5 dB is a strong cut. I think it's more a trend that more shows that the CBBN might favor a region that will be difficult to access at the LHC. These are details I think that would be very interesting to work out.
But has anybody looked actually at these models where you have nearly supersymmetric, almost exactly supersymmetric xenon sector?
That I don't know.
I think that
you just double it in the super potential, right? Double times the scale, right?
In the supergravity effect, it is also induced a xenon mass, but one can play with the scale potential for that.
Yeah, we'll just play with the global supersymmetry.
But they take the mass arbitrary anyway.
Right, no, I was just, it's one of the interesting alternatives, right? Because it would be sort of a KV scale particles, and you could have, them radiated a little bit, and they would be dark matter, sort of not necessarily stable. So. I don't know.
So our EBN constraints make it uncomfortable for thermal genesis.
Yep.
I was wondering, you talked about the our entropy production as a way out. What do you play with thermal genesis, let's say, adding more gauge?
The claim is this 10 to the 9 is like the most straightforward model for thermal epigenesis that you would take without fine-tuned heavy neutrinos, right? If you have degenerate heavy neutrinos, you can have resonant leptogenesis, and people look at that. Yeah. And then this reheating temperature needed to have that working, that becomes lower. Yeah. But I like this normal standard way of thermal leptogenesis where you don't do any fine tuning, and it's consistent with the right amount of neutrino masses that you infer from oscillations and so on. But who knows? Resonant leptogenesis could still be an option. And there are, of course, many other baryogenesis models. It's just,
I've always thought that before we see supersymmetry, we'll see more gauge degrees of freedom, I think. That's my thought.
More gauge degrees of freedom?
Yeah.
For example, you want to see
supersymmetry? Like, you right-handed weak bosons and another singlet, maybe.
The MSSM, we wouldn't want to see those things.
Well, I think it would make it more diverse.
You mean to produce the right-hand neutrino?
No, he's
talking about additional gauge groups.
A zinc line.
I really think that if nature chooses supersymmetry, we can be super lucky. Because then you have, if you start talking to these collider people, LHC will become extremely difficult, right? You have 9 interactions taking place in the same beam crossing, and it will be a big mess, right? And supersymmetry, although you have 100 parameters, or if you want to have CP, you have even more, but still you have this clear relationship between the couplings. So the gluino coupling and the gluon coupling, you have a very, very clear prediction for that. So with such guiding principles, it might be possible, even although we have this mess, to dig out that it's supersymmetry. If it's something else, that will be much more difficult.
Very well. More questions? Let's thank you.
Thanks.